This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
one stark finding is that a large number of children those in school, they don't even reach minimum competencies at different levels.
That's Sajita Bashir, the World Bank's Educational Regional Manager for Africa, speaking to VOA's Ruben Chama about challenges to education in Africa. Details coming up.
Also, Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari meets U.S. President Donald Trump on Monday to discuss economic growth, terrorism, and other issues. Heavy rains continue to threaten Kenya and Somalia, and for the first time, there is a new museum in the United States that recognizes the victims of racial terrorism and lynching.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, Monday summit between Nigeria President Muhammadu Buhari and U.S. President Donald Trump comes at a difficult moment in bilateral relations. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with two experts on why Trump may have issued the invitation now.
When the White House meeting was announced, many Africa experts, including John Campbell, doubted that it would accomplish much given recent history. Campbell is the Ralph Bunche Senior Fellow for Africa Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and a former U.S. ambassador to Nigeria.
There was the unfortunate characterization of Africa and certain Caribbean states made by the president a couple of months ago that caused a good deal of pain in Africa, and that pain has not altogether dissipated. So, from an African perspective, I would have said that the administration does not appear to be particularly friendly.
Or, from Campbell's perspective, particularly well-prepared. He points out that several top diplomatic posts to Africa remain open, including the Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs.
What I cannot tell you, because I literally have no idea, is what the White House's agenda is.
The White House says the visit is intended to further the two countries' shared interests, including economic growth and reforms. Campbell is dubious. American exporters once hoped to tap into the Nigerian market, now nearly 200 million people strong. But today, says Campbell, most Nigerians live on less than $2 a day.
That means most Nigerians literally do not have discretionary income to spend on things like shampoo or razor blades.
America used to import 1 million barrels of Nigerian oil a day. Now we import none. West Africa historian Gregory Mann of New York's Columbia University says that doesn't mean that U.S. business interests in Nigeria have dried up.
These major U.S. multinational corporations that are based in the U.S., they have a presence in Nigeria, even if the oil they're producing there is being shipped elsewhere.
Security and the fight against terrorism are certain to be high on the agenda Monday. Boko Haram is still active in Nigeria. However, Campbell says alleged human rights abuses by Nigeria's security forces provide a complication. He cites an American law which requires the suspension of U.S. military assistance to any nation whose security forces are credibly accused of such abuses until the charges have been investigated and resolved. President Barack Obama halted the delivery of several military planes to Nigeria after the government bombed a Nigerian refugee camp. Campbell pointed out that in contrast, the Trump administration and the U.S. Congress recently approved the sale of some relatively light military aircraft to Buhari's government. According to Gregory Mann, that sale was consistent with Trump's emphasis on military force over diplomacy. And given that a huge number of the State Department's Africa experts have quit or been fired,
there's no referee. All this depends on desk officers doing their work. If there's nobody to say, well, these are the things you must take into account, then the law is not worth the paper that it's written on.
In the view of Ambassador John Campbell and others, there is an intimate relationship between a respect for humanitarian concerns, including human rights, and national security. So it's up to Trump and Buhari to negotiate that balance. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
And as reported earlier, Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari will visit Washington on Monday. And a White House statement says Buhari and U.S. President Donald Trump will discuss economic growth, terrorism, and other issues. The statement called the U.S. relationship with Nigeria deep and strong. It said the two leaders will discuss ways of promoting mutual prosperity. The scheduled meeting will be the second between the two leaders. President Trump met Buhari in September last year on the sidelines of the United Nations General Assembly. Eugene Abels is a foreign affairs analyst based in Port Harcourt. He told reporter Mike Mbonye that President Buhari should seek American technical assistance in conducting the 2019 polls and also in providing intelligence to fight Boko Haram terrorists.
Now, the question is, what have we benefited from the last visit? Nothing. Yes, because those in the Western nations, Western powers, do not have time to waste. So if you don't come with clear, specific, and concise demand which falls within the strata of their national interest, you're just going for, You're going for a party, and that's what it'll likely end up be like.
Are you saying that we're not expecting anything from it?
For me, no. The last one, all they got was a helicopter. All they got was an offer to buy aircraft. And the aircraft, the conditions were even, they were unable to meet them, because even me, I would not support those kind of conditionalities to procure equipment. And equipment are not sold off the shelf.
What should be Buhari's agenda during talks with American officials?
Well, it's practically, they need money, they need support. But for me, they need technology for the forthcoming elections. So I would have wished that they seek the American support, the government support, to enable the elections go flawless. They need support in terms of the military. Security has become a big issue. And security in being run in the old way will not go. So you need intelligence support. Yes, for training, for recruitment, and for implementation. So we need the Americans to go. They don't need to, but they are support people. They know how they run these things. But if you don't meet the conditions which they set for you, the Americans won't do that for you.
Do you think President Donald Trump will provide more assistance to Nigeria to fight insurgency?
If the Nigerians are able to provide, if our president is able to provide a deliberate program which falls within the American national interests, that's only when that can happen.
What specifically would Nigeria want in terms of U.S. military assistance?
Intelligence and implementation, training, intelligence, training, and implementation.
President Buhari's administration has been accused by the opposition of being biased in the fight against corruption and clamping down on them. Do you see these issues being raised during the visit?
Maybe. Maybe and maybe not. It depends on the mood of President Trump. Because for a state visit, there's certain things they will be prepared for it. Certain things will be discussed. Issues will be raised about. But if it borders on the issues of violation of human rights will come up, they'll raise that with him. Now, you wonder what I'm talking about. Talk about the killing of over 350 something Shiites in Kaduna, where there was mass burial. The recent incident at the fountain where the Shiites were prevented from processing. The arrest of the Bring Back Our Girls. So the issues of fundamental human rights will occur. And that issue must be raised. Insecurity, rights, food security, and the rise of insurgency. They raise those fundamental things with them.
That was foreign affairs analyst Eugene Abels. He spoke with reporter Mike Mbonye in Port Harcourt, Nigeria.
Heavy rains continue to threaten Kenya and Somalia. The UN says floods in Kenya have displaced over 200,000 people and killed 72. Among the most affected countries are Turkana, Tana River, Garissa, and Mandera. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, or OCHA, says over 8,400 acres of farmland have been submerged and more than 6,000 livestock killed in the counties. Weather forecasters say the Masinga and Kamburu dams, fed by water from Mount Kenya, are reaching high levels. Continued rains may force authorities to release water from the dams, thus putting at risk downstream villages. Residents are being encouraged to seek higher ground. Also affected are the Kenyan camps of Dadaab, which house more than 225,000 Somali refugees. OCHA says hundreds have sought shelter in schools. Forecasters warn heavy rains are expected to continue in parts of Kenya. The Kenyan Red Cross, the UN, and other agencies have provided more than 100,000 homes with shelter material and food items. In Somalia, the Norwegian Refugee Council says over 420,000 people have been affected by flooding this month. The NRC says in Baidoa alone, over 170,000 people have lost their homes and access to clean water and functioning latrines. The head of the NRC in Somalia, Victor Moses, called the situation a ticking time bomb for cholera, malaria, and other diseases. Heavy rains are expected to continue in the coming week, and flooding is forecast to continue in the Juba and Shabelle River basins.
More than 4,000 black Americans were lynched between the 1870s and 1950. Thousands more were abused and killed during the era of slavery. Now, a new museum is the first in the United States to recognize the victims of racial terrorism and lynching. Its founder, the Equal Justice Initiative, a nonprofit organization working in marginalized and impoverished communities, hopes the National Memorial for Peace and Justice will help change the national narrative about race. VOA's Kane Farbo covered opening day activities and has more from Montgomery, Alabama.
She had traveled to Alabama all the way from California to be here for this moment and had managed to get in line early to secure one of the sold out opening day tickets that gave her access to the Legacy Museum. So it was a surprise to Asoke Femi that the hardest part of her day was putting into words what she had just witnessed.
My experience in there is that it's so painful.
Built on the site of a slave warehouse in Montgomery, once the epicenter of the slave trade in the United States, the Legacy Museum, from enslavement to mass incarceration, is filled with exhibits that serve as a catalyst for understanding what blacks in the United States have historically endured. Civil rights leader Reverend Jesse Jackson was an early supporter of the museum and the nearby National Memorial for Peace and Justice, an expansive monument and park that honors the victims of lynching and brings the reality of slavery's legacy out of the shadows.
We must face the truth of our origins. We are a post-genocidal, post-slavery, post-Jim Crow society.
But not a post-racial society, says Mark Potok, former senior fellow with the Southern Poverty Law Center.
You know, it is white people in this country and in the South in particular who are so averse to, you know, facing the past squarely.
Potok says racism and bigotry, particularly in the state that now hosts this museum and memorial, are not yet consigned to the history books.
A very short time ago, the majority of white people in Alabama voted to keep segregated schools in the state constitution.
Jackson believes the biggest barrier to progress today is the one that keeps people from the ballot box.
There are 4 million blacks in the South unregistered to vote.
And that in many ways, that's the way forward. You know, it's not beating up white supremacists in the streets of Charlottesville. It is really changing the people who represent us.
Asoke Femi, still reeling from her walk through the images and displays that deal with powerful and uncomfortable truths, sees hope in the crowds around her.
The love that it took to do this, the commitment, the courage, and the fact that everybody's here, that it's not just something that black people are coming to, everybody, even if they couldn't form the words, they couldn't say the words, they want the healing. They want the healing of America. They want their hearts to be set free.
Kane Farbaugh, VOA News, Montgomery, Alabama.
Past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. The World Bank says some 50 million children in Africa remain out of school despite considerable gains in boosting primary and lower secondary school enrollment. Based on its recent study of 40 African countries, the bank says most countries in sub-Saharan counties are facing a serious learning crisis. Speaking to VOA in Nairobi on the sidelines of a regional conference on education, a top World Bank education expert urged African nations to address the problem. From the Kenyan capital, Ruben Chama reports.
Sajitha Bashir, the World Bank's Education Regional Manager for Africa, says its latest report shows that there are widespread differences on the continent.
One group of countries, mainly in Southern Africa and Eastern Africa, Kenya, Mauritius, and so on, they have made substantial progress in ensuring all children attend primary school as well as lower secondary school. At the other end, there's a group of countries, which we're calling Group 4 countries, which are really very delayed. They have not yet even completed universalization of primary education, and enrollment rates in lower secondary education are less than 50%. And this group of countries is mainly along the Sahel belt.
Bashir presented the World Bank's new study at a three-day conference of senior government officials and education ministers from 54 African countries, activists, and representatives from UN agencies. The report on 44 nations covers not just how many children attend school, but also what they learn.
One stark finding is that a large number of children in school, they don't even reach minimum competencies at different levels. At different grade levels. And so this is a big learning crisis in Africa. Our book then goes on to explain how countries could address some of these problems and what are some of those problems that we should address as priority.
The report shows that learning levels across sub-Saharan Africa are low. Among second grade students assessed in several countries, three quarters could not count beyond 80, and 40% could not do a one-digit addition problem. In reading, between 50 and 80% of children in second grade could not answer a single question about a short passage they had read, and a large proportion could not read a single word. But Bashir says there have also been improvements in some states, including South Africa, Zimbabwe, Namibia, Kenya, Ghana, and Mauritius.
And some of these countries actually had quite a lot of challenges in the 90s, and yet they have made progress. They also perform better in learning. So one of the messages of our study is that there isn't really a trade-off between quantity and quality. If you get children into school and make sure they complete, and you also invest in improving the quality, then you will get better learning results. Having said that, even these countries are far behind when it comes to international learning assessments, and that shows that overall the region is behind.
Sarah Anyang Agbo, Commissioner for Human Resources, Science and Technology at the African Union, says Africa cannot address its development needs without first addressing education.
We cannot talk about health, entrepreneurship, employment, etc. without education. And the skilled and competent citizens that we need for the Africa we want, it is only by education. And what kind of education? Quality education and the right kind of education, because the world is going technological.
The World Bank says the first step is spending more on education. Although several African countries having increased their school budgets, the average spending per pupil in primary education is only about $200 annually, significantly lower than other regions. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
A report by the Zimbabwe Human Rights Commission alleges that the ruling ZANU-PF party is taking advantage of teachers, students, and school resources for its own political purposes. Reporter Kudzai Zanawash has more details.
The report was undertaken after various teachers' associations complained about the ruling party's activities within the nation's schools. Obet Masaraure is the president of the Amalgamated Rural Teachers Association.
We approached the commission with a complaint that was capturing three particular areas. To begin with, it was the violation of children's rights. Secondly, we're looking at the violation of the right to the freedom of association of both the teachers and the learners. Thirdly, we're looking at the right to education for the learners themselves.
Masara Wure adds that they made the complaint after noting some worrying violations.
So these three were being violated with impunity by ZANPF. They were being violated because ZANPF was disrupting learning in schools when they would hold their private political rallies on school premises.
He adds that teachers were made to take part in the party activities, even if they were not members of ZANPF. Students were forced to attend rallies, which also made use of school resources, including furniture and buses. All these allegations have been documented in the Human Rights Commission's report. Christopher Mutsangwa, a presidential advisor and a senior ZANU-PF member, refused to speak with this reporter on the sidelines of a public dialogue recently, citing he was running behind time. When later called for comment, he refused to speak, saying he was busy with primary elections that will determine the ruling party's national candidates. William Mutumanje, widely known as AC Lumumba, is a ZANU-PF member and occasional critic of his own party.
ZANU-PF has done some appalling things. ZANU-PF has done some terrible things. And ZANU-PF has to fix itself. ZANU-PF is in a mess. It's hard to defend ZANU-PF, but it's the same with any political party. They are also trying to fix themselves. Both political parties have hurt people in the past, and they both have to fix themselves. But I don't speak on behalf of ZANU-PF.
The report was compiled when ZANU-PF was under the leadership of long-serving leader Robert Mugabe, whose political career came to an abrupt end after a military intervention in November 2017. His successor and long-time lieutenant, Emmerson Mnangagwa, has been preaching reform, but Masara Wure says nothing has changed.
No. ZANU-PF has maintained its colors. The same violations are still underway. You will note that recently in Mberengwa, just before schools closed, we have a member of parliament for Mberengwa West who had forced schools to close, and he declared his own day equal to Civil Servants Day, which is not even on the calendar. We obviously school kids were forced to that rally. Teachers were also forced to participate in this political gathering.
The Zimbabwe Human Rights Commission has recommended that the country's electoral commission introduce a code of conduct stating that political parties will not access schools for their political activities. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, peepas. This is Heather Maxwell. Coming up on Music Time in Africa, I've got amazing music for you. From Cameroon, Mali, Zambia, Reunion, Nigeria, and Zimbabwe, Ghana's vote on most popular song of the year for 2017, hint, hint, Zongo. And a fabulous interview and live music session with Kenyan guitar masters John Nzeze and Peter Akwabi.
Angelica means it is Angelina, but Angelina, I just twisted the name to call it Angelica.
Join me this Friday and Saturday at 1505 and 20500 UTC. Music time in Africa. Yeah, babies.
On the next edition of VOA's Press Conference USA, host Carol Castiel goes to Capitol Hill to talk with Congressman Brad Schneider, a Democrat from Illinois. They'll discuss a wide range of domestic and foreign policy issues facing the Trump administration, such as this week's visit by French President Emmanuel Macron, as well as Iran, North Korea, and trade policies. That's Press Conference USA this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.